Hi, everyone. Eve Harrow, Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. I'm in a beautiful apartment right now in Abu Tor, which is right on the seam line. It's what is a mixed neighborhood. Before 1967, this was a neighborhood that was divided between Jewish Jerusalem and Jordanian-occupied Jerusalem, and now after 67, been reunited. It's the perfect place for the home of Jonathan Speier, whom I've known for quite a while, journalist and Mideast analyst. So thanks for taking some time today.
Very nice to speak to you again, Eve.
So it's interesting. You describe yourself as a journalist and Mideast analyst. One would expect that within the title of journalist in the Middle East, would be Middle East analyst, yet we find very often that people are reporting, and you report for a great deal in Syria. I'm going to talk about that with you at length in a couple minutes. But what do you find that there are some journalists who just kind of are fed things and not really analyzing what they're reporting?
Yeah, I do. I mean, for me, it's very important to have both those hats. And this is kind of quite a central aspect of what I do, because I believe that the one ought to help the other. That is to say that you can be a better analyst if you are also somebody who works in the field and has a great number of sources in the field and is able to call on those and to get original information and to get out there. And you are a better reporter also, in my opinion, if you have the depth of knowledge, hopefully, to be able to analyze also. So these are two professions, so to speak, that ought to aid one another. If they're being done right, then they do aid one another. And somebody who only does one and not the other, in my opinion, is less suitable, so to speak, at the thing they're engaging in. Reporters, it's a good example. I mean, people who try to report on the Middle East, and we're both familiar with examples of these, who have, you know, no real knowledge of the region, no background knowledge, no knowledge of the history, no knowledge of the context, are people whose reporting inevitably is going to suffer as a result of that. And that's something that we see. So I'm trying very hard to do both.
Well, it's not only that the reporting suffers, but in an inability to really get information out, for example, in places like Syria. So many people's opinions are based on what they're reading in the newspaper, what that person is reporting.
Yeah.
Huge responsibility on the media right now that I'm not quite sure that they're fulfilling in the way that we need, except for you, of course. Just a couple minutes of your background and how you got to where you are right now.
Well, I've been here in Israel, actually here in Jerusalem, now getting on for 27 years. I'm originally from London in England. So I came here at the very start of the the end of the 80s, 90s. Was when I first began to spend time here. I have a doctorate from the London School of Economics. I've been doing this stuff now, I guess, for just over, about a decade and a half, this kind of work. But I was interested and involved with study of the Middle East and observation of the Middle East pretty much from the start. I came here, of course, because I made Aliyah, and I came here as a Jew from a Zionist family. But also I've been fascinated by the Middle East and by the Arab world pretty much all the way through. So I'm kind of able right now to do both those things, to be a Jew who lives in Jerusalem and at the same time to be engaged with the Middle East and the Arab world, and that's pretty great.
So explain to us, you just wrote a fabulous article, and you're always writing terrific articles, but this one was especially, I found even poignant, because you talked about what's going on in Syria from personal experience. Yet through the article, and anybody, you can reach me, you can write to me, I'm happy to send you the link of Jonathan Speier's last article, Eve at thelandofisrael.com. Tremendous empathy for people whom on a given day are supposedly, you're an Israeli and you're Syria, are the enemies of Israel, have been an intractable enemy for a long time, fought wars with us.
Yes.
Yet you're in there, you're seeing the people, and one can't help but get the feeling that you're just heartbroken for some of the atrocities that are happening over there. How does that work? First of all, how do you get into Syria? And then how do you have all these different ideas, thoughts, and very human feelings all at the same time?
Yeah, well, this was an article where the Jerusalem Report magazine asked me to write a retrospective, really, of 5 years of reporting and analysis on the Syrian civil war. So what I did was I also kind of went back to some of the articles I'd written and some of the experiences I'd had reporting in Syria, you know, in some of the most conflict-ridden, most intense, you know, parts of that country and that conflict. The thing with regard to empathy is that, you know, you can't really not feel empathy. I mean, you'd have to be, you know, some kind of very, very detached person not to feel empathy when you you know, you see, especially, you know, kids and innocent people suffering, you know, and people being threatened with violent death through absolutely no fault of their own.
Right.
This, I think, is something which, you know, as human beings, we can all hopefully relate to, and you can't not. At the same time, you know, something which I guess I didn't put in the article, but which is the other side of that same coin, is that as a reporter in those environments, you can't really show any of that in real time, because you have to get on with your work, you know, so you can't really express that. So in a certain sense, I guess writing the article, I wanted to express that because I hadn't been able to express it in the moment. In the moment, you just have to keep going and do what you do, because otherwise, you know, otherwise you can't function and you can't actually do what you need to do, which is to get the information out and to get it to the place where it needs to be. And in a certain sense, the greatest service you can do those people, such as it is, and often it doesn't change anything, but, you know, is to get their story out, so at least people know, at least humanity, you know, can't say it didn't know about the crimes being committed also by the Assad regime, also by elements of the Sunni rebels as well, of course also by ISIS and the worst among the jihadis. You know, that's all going on, and what we're trying to do, I suppose, ultimately, is to document that, so people can't, you know, so nobody can say they didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
How do I get in? So, well, this is, you know, the logistics can be complex, because as you know, Syria has been an immensely challenging environment for information gathering, both the regime and at times, certainly the jihadis among the rebels have done their best to close down information gathering to prevent people from, reporters from being able to get in and find out what's going on. At the same time, neither of those elements have been completely successful in that, you know, a relatively small number of people, of whom I guess I'm one, have found ways to nevertheless get into the country. Not all parts of the country, some parts have been genuinely shut off, but some parts of the country crossing the border illegally, so-called, with smugglers or with fighters, you mm-hmm. know, building up those contacts, making use of them. This has become part of the bread and butter of what I've been doing for the last few years. And only through those kind of that kind of approach has it been possible to report on the Syrian war.
You're not afraid? I mean, there are reporters who've gone in there and not come out.
Yeah. Again, I mean, this is an interesting thing. It's the difference between real time and reflecting, because again, in real time, you can't really allow yourself to be afraid in those situations, because then you wouldn't be able to function.
Mm-hmm.
So if, and you know, everybody's different, and it's not some big macho or honor thing, just people's personalities are made differently, and certain people, I think, wouldn't necessarily be able to achieve that level of detachment, and so they wouldn't do that kind of stuff. And if you just find, for whatever reason, that you can, then you can do it. But it's absolutely vital to not be afraid in real time, because then you won't be able to function. Reflecting on those situations and looking back on them, yeah, sometimes I kind of think, goodness me, how did I, you know,
what was I doing?
You know, did I really do that? Was that really me that did that? Was that really me that, you know, climbed over the border fence or that crossed the Tigris River, all this other fun stuff we've been up to over the last few years? Yeah, so, you know, when it's time to do it, you just do it, and people tend to cope, and that's how it's done.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that your experience, that you have to be careful what you write because you're afraid that it's got to be a certain level of trust of the people
mm-hmm.
who take you through there?
Mm-hmm.
Yet you have to write about your experiences there in such a way, A, that doesn't endanger them either,
yes.
or they're not going to do it again,
mm-hmm.
But also that they wouldn't get upset with you and the next time say, hey,
mm-hmm.
you know, you wrote something that I would prefer you didn't write. I'm either not letting you in or not letting you out.
Yeah, there is, you know, there's always an element of, what would be the word, of just cooperation. You build up a relationship of cooperation and of trust over time. Usually, especially at this stage of the game, you know, I'm not working anymore with people that I don't know. I tend to know the people that I'm doing this kind of stuff with. We've met before, we've worked together before. So there's an element of trust that builds up over time. But yeah, absolutely, one thing you have to bear in mind is not to betray that, you know, even if you might be tempted to you know, because you really want to say A or B or describe A or B. You know, sometimes you can't because you don't want to betray, or you mustn't betray that that confidence. So it's a constant, I suppose, negotiation is the right word.
With yourself.
Yeah, with yourself and with the environment you're working in. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you get into Syria. Do you have a plan once you get in there? Are there particular places that you know that you want to get to, or
yeah.
you just kind of roll with it, whatever's open, whatever opportunity
well, this
you
is
have
a question.
To
I,
get through?
Yeah, I do. I always do have a plan, but I'm always aware of the fact that, you know, you have to be ready for that to change, and you have to be ready also if it's not possible, you know, to get where you want to go. Sometimes you just have to accept that. And at the same time, what I've always found is that new opportunities come along in real time, which you weren't necessarily expecting or didn't necessarily plan for, and then you have to know how to jump at those. I mean, for example, in summer 2014, when I was in Iraq and Syria during the ISIS push into Iraq, when the Yazidis were trapped on Sinjar Mountain, so I entered into northeast Syria with the Kurdish YPG fighters, and I very, very much wanted to get to Sinjar Mountain. A lot of journalists were trying to, and it was something I was absolutely determined to do. But there was a lot of fighting going on in a place called Jazza on the road to Sinjar, and in the end, I just wasn't able to do it. I still got plenty of good work done, but it was frustrating but at the same time, the YPG were saying, "Well, look, you know, it's just too dangerous. We can't drive you past Jazza; people can get killed. There's a battle going on down there. There's no other road through." So I kind of just had to accept, okay, after a while, Sinjar ain't going to happen. But at the same time, I was able to visit, you know, refugee camps where some of the Yazidis who'd just been rescued were, and interview wounded Kurdish fighters who'd been fighting up there, and, you know, visit some of the frontline positions a little bit to the north of Sinjar. So I was still able to do a lot. I'd had a plan. The plan didn't exactly work out, but nevertheless, it was a very successful reporting trip. So it's always a kind of combination of having a plan, but at the same time, being willing to improvise, being willing to change the plan, being willing to take other opportunities as they come along.
Do you take food with you? I know that seems like a very simple question, but
no,
you're going into an area where people are starving to death. Do you ever worry that you're not going to have food?
Well, it's an interesting... There have been occasions...
This is a Jewish mother.
Yeah, no, there have been occasions where, I mean, you know, you don't eat a great deal of meat, or you don't eat a great deal of good food. But, you know, there's never... Where I've been, there's never been any shortage of basic, you know, vegetables and a bit of bread. You know, I remember once coming out of Kobani a few years ago, also I think in 2014, earlier in that year. And I sort of came back to a place called Gaziantep in Turkey, where we came back to after crossing the border. And it suddenly kind of occurred to me, I've been in there a couple of weeks, and it suddenly kind of occurred to me, wow, I haven't eaten meat for 2 weeks. And I went they've got some amazing Turkish restaurants in Gaziantep. And I ordered this Turkish dish called Iskander, which is kind of meat and yogurt and tomato sauce, and just wolfed it down. And I remember that as being one of the absolutely joyful, you know, moment. Oh yeah, because you know, you don't eat meat for 2 weeks, and you eat this meager food. You don't notice it at the time, but suddenly you realize, wow, yeah, I haven't eaten properly for 2 weeks, and then you eat properly,
and then you can, which a lot of the people.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
Are there any good guys there? You know, I'd like people to read the article, so I don't want to review the whole article and all the different organizations there that you talk about, Jabal al-Nusrat, et cetera, and the Assad people.
Yeah.
Aside from the victims, obviously, the people like the Yazidis, the people who are not directly involved in the fighting, but among all the so-called rebel groups, is there anybody who could turn Syria into a country that somebody would want to live in?
Well, I think that Syria is fragmented now, and Syria as a country doesn't really exist anymore. And what you have now is three or four different areas of control held by different political military organizations, of which the Assad regime and its allies effectively constitute one. Now, they don't really constitute, I think, anything more legitimate than any of the other areas. In that regard, I would say that the most livable area and the most well-ordered area, though it's not perfect by any means, but is the Kurdish northeast. I mean, that's, I think the Syrian Kurds have managed to carve out
enclave.
The most livable, normal, you know, enclave currently in existence. I would say that if we're sort of handing out marks to anybody, you know, nobody gets full marks, but that the Kurdish YPG and PYD and those organizations and that authority is the most sane and most livable place that there currently is on the territory of the former Syria. The other element that I wouldn't want to completely forget is that there are, you know, still some of the more secular elements from the old Free Syrian Army who are people that, I won't say good guys, but who are people that one can have, you know, a conversation with. The problem with them is that they're really very weak, and they've been very much marginalized by the Sunni Islamist element among the rebellion, which is now absolutely dominant, of which ISIS is only the most extreme example. But, you know, it's the Sunni Islamists, and particularly the Salafis, who've basically come to dominate the rebellion. So apart from the Kurds, I would say some of the remnants of the old rebellion, you know, the rebellion that first emerged in 2011, 2012, those are the people that you can look at as the most, as maybe, you know, positive in one way or another. The regime people, of course, absolutely not. The regime and the various people around them. And, of course, also not the Sunni Islamist rebels.
Mm-hmm. Do you give any hope for the so-called peace talks that are going on right now, or there's some kind of ceasefire happening? Is that real?
The ceasefire is largely held. I mean, the ceasefire that came in February 27th is largely held. But people should remember, we should remember that there's not one war going on in Syria now. I mean, you can count maybe four or five separate wars. And the ceasefire only covers one of these five wars. The ceasefire covers the war, of course, between the Assad regime and the rebellion against it. But one should be aware there's also the war between Islamic State and the Kurdish YPG. There's also a war intermittently between the Kurdish YPG and the Sunni rebels. There's also a war between Islamic State and the Assad regime. So, you know, there's also a war between PKK and the Turks, which takes place sometimes also on the soil of northern Syria. So these are all, you know, separate conflicts, and none of them, with the exception of Assad against the rebels, is covered by the ceasefire. So fighting is continuing in Syria, but the particular ceasefire that relates to Assad versus the rebels has held actually surprisingly well. Now, it doesn't mean there isn't a war in Syria anymore, but it does mean, for example, that humanitarian aid's been able to get into parts of the country which, you know, didn't have that for a long period, and that fewer people are dying as a result of the ceasefire. So it's absolutely incomplete, but it is having some effect. However, if we try to sort of extrapolate from that, does the ceasefire have a chance of turning into a genuine settlement of the conflict? My answer would be absolutely not. I mean, there's a ceasefire because both regime and rebellion had an interest in a ceasefire. But, you know, the talks that are taking place in Geneva have such major stumbling blocks for progress that I can't really see them getting anywhere. And indeed, they're not currently getting anywhere. It's most importantly, with regard to the issue of political transition and the future of Bashar Assad. Mm-hmm. From the rebellion's point of view, there's no role for Assad in any transition. From the regime's point of view, Bashar Assad is absolutely staying. So, you know, there's no basis for agreement.
Mm-hmm. There's no compromise over there. No. How do you see the... Now, the Russians are saying that they're pulling out. Is that really true? The Iranians also. Do you see that actually happening on the ground?
No, they're not. I mean, they're not pulling out. They made this announcement, of course, right. But there's no indications whatsoever of what we would see as a withdrawal. What happened was that they had a very particular offensive in the northwest of the country, which they've largely concluded. And the reason they've concluded it is because the goal of the offensive was to stop the rebellion from pushing into the populated part of Latakia province, which is the regime's heartland. That's really why the Russians came in on September 30th of last year.
They want a Mediterranean port.
Yeah, they have the Mediterranean port, in Tartus, of course, and they were determined to defend that and also determined to keep Assad in his his chair, so to speak. And he was in real danger of losing at that moment because the rebels, a new rebel alliance called Jaish al-Fatah, was doing very well and was just about looking like it might have pushed into Western Latakia province. The Russians came in to prevent that. They succeeded in their mission in that regard. And so they've withdrawn some of the combat aircraft and so on, which were engaged in that particular fight. But it doesn't mean they've withdrawn from the country as a whole. We've just seen the fight down in Palmyra last week, mm-hmm. when the regime reconquered Palmyra from ISIS. Well, Russian attack helicopters were engaged in that. Russian special forces were on the ground, as they've now, you know, openly declared. So no, the Russians are not pulling out. They've concluded a particular offensive, but they're still very much in there.
How do you see this as an Israeli? You know, you're not just a journalist going in there reporting. Mm-hmm. You're someone who is a Zionist who picked yourself up and made your home here in Israel. Right now, Israel has more or less stayed out of the mess. How do you see that continuing?
Well, I think that Israel's actually done quite well. I mean, you know, Israel correctly defines the Syrian war as one in which Israel has no dog in the fight. That's to say, Israel doesn't really have an interest in regime victory, doesn't particularly have an interest in the victory of the Sunni, largely Islamist rebels, which means that Israel's goal is really twofold. Firstly, to keep the Syrian war from spilling over into Israeli territory. And secondly, as we've seen, the desire to prevent the transfer of sophisticated weapons systems from Syria to Hezbollah
in Lebanon.
Yeah, those are the goals. The first of them has been pretty well achieved. That's to say, if we think of the fact that the Syrian war has impacted hugely on every country that has a border with Syria, with the exception of Israel, it's impacted hugely on Iraq, hugely on Jordan, on Lebanon and on Turkey, all of which have millions of refugees, all of which are seeing the political fallout coming from the war and so on and so forth. Israel's not. So pretty high marks for the quiet Israeli policy east of Qunetra Crossing of ensuring that the government, the Assad regime, don't dominate that area, of ensuring that certain rebels dominate it, other rebels don't. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very quiet policy, but it's been pretty well pursued.
It seems like some cooperation between Putin and Netanyahu also.
That is correct. When the Russians came in, there was clearly real Israeli concern. And the Israeli concern was the following. Israel doesn't want the Syrian government to come down to the area immediately east of Qunetra. And if the Russians were to help them try to achieve that, they could do it. So I think Israel, you know, Netanyahu we saw, and Eisenkot and Herzl Halevi, you know, hurried over to Moscow in the days after September 30th. And I assume what they were doing was two things. Firstly, putting in place a deconfliction agreement or arrangement with the Russians whereby Israeli and Russian planes wouldn't get in each other's way mm-hmm. over the skies of Syria. And I think probably secondly, getting an assurance that Russian goals were not necessarily the same as those of the regime and the Iranians, and that they would not help the regime and the Iranians come down to the area just east of Quneitra. As of now, that seems to have been achieved. With regard to weapon systems, it's much more difficult to gauge, of course. We hear about these reports of air raids intermittently by Israel against weapons convoys. But, of course, we can't know for certain that very new and sophisticated systems haven't reached Hezbollah. To some degree, we'll only find out, you know, when the next war with Hezbollah comes along.
Well, do you think that the fact that the sanctions have been lifted on Iran is going to enable them to help Hezbollah, not necessarily through Syria, but they may have other ways of doing it now they have the money?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, they were, you know, we should remember that Iran, even when it was under real and biting sanctions, was finding ways to help Hezbollah, was finding ways to help the very expensive campaign of keeping Bashar Assad in place, was aiding the Iraqi Shia the militias. So, you know, a foot was aiding the Houthi rebels in Yemen and so on and so forth, was aiding Palestinian Islamic Jihad. You know, so a very full portfolio of regional allies were being maintained by the Iranians, even when they were under biting sanctions. Now, with the JCPOA having been signed and with, you know, anywhere between $56 and $150 billion about to come back online for the Iranians, depending on which estimate you choose to accept, of course they're going to be well equipped to you know, to be much more generous and lavish in future with regard to helping their regional allies, including undoubtedly Hezbollah, which in many ways remains the key, the jewel in the crown, so to speak, from the point of view of Iranian regional subversion and interference.
So now one country that you haven't mentioned is Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. I was just in the States and somebody there said to me that he predicts, someone who's fairly in the know, that Iran is going to attack Saudi Arabia within the next year. Because right now, that whole Syria playground, Saudi Arabia is really not so much a part of it, at least not on the front page part of it. I'm sure they're doing some dirty work underneath. What do you think about that? Where do you think Saudi Arabia fits into this whole maelstrom of the Middle East right now?
Well, Saudi Arabia certainly sees the, you know, is certainly hugely worried by the JCPOA, the nuclear deal. It's hugely worried by Iranian advances across the region. Sees Iran as a challenger for regional domination, and is seeking, therefore, to try to stem Iranian advances where it can. Of course, we had this Saudi Arabian commitment in Yemen, which has prevented the Houthi rebels, the Iranian client, from completing the conquest of Yemen. They're still there, but they've been held back in half the country, in the southern part of the country, which is impressive. The Saudis have also thrown money at the Syrian problem. They are backing certain of the militias, the rebel militias on the rebel side in Syria. So, you know, Saudi Arabia is engaged across the region. I think that King Salman is a little bit different to his predecessor, King Abdullah, in the sense of being proactive, firstly, more proactive, and also, it may be something which should concern us, much more willing to work with political Islam than was the previous king. King Abdullah was very, very worried by the Muslim Brotherhood because he feared the possibility the Muslim Brothers could make a revolution in Saudi Arabia if anybody
could. As they tried to do in Egypt.
Absolutely. Right? And this current king seems to be more willing to try to make use of political Islam as a potential ally. So that's what's happening. We have a political war, a kind of cold war, going on between Iran and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia all the way across the region, with Iran backing its clients, the Saudis backing their clients, usually confronting one another. When it comes to the issue of a direct attack, if that's what you were...
That's what someone mentioned to me.
My sense is that that's quite unlikely. I mean, you know, we don't have a crystal ball, but my sense is that the Iranians don't like direct attacks. The Iranians don't like making direct use of their own armed forces. What they are good at doing is using proxies. What they're much more keen on is having Arabs die for them rather
like
than
like Hezbollah attack Israel instead
absolutely.
Of them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. Because the Iranians don't really invest a great deal in conventional armed forces. They invest in above and below conventional armed forces. They invest in ballistic missiles, the missile program, and they invest in regional proxies. When it comes to their actual armed forces that you would use in a conventional attack on another state, you know, the Iranian armed forces are not that well developed and not that well invested in.
So you're saying they're still trying to protect themselves. It's interesting because you say they'd rather have Arabs die for them.
Mm.
And I know that a lot of listeners, unfortunately, are going to say, well, but Iranians are Arabs too, which is a very, very big mistake to make.
No, yeah, they're not. I mean, the Iranians are absolutely
that's
a different
one of the biggest
culture.
Insults you can give them if you say that,
yes.
That they're Arabs.
First of all, that's right. There's a whole healthy list of insulting stereotypes that Persians and Arabs have about one another.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly the Persians are from a different history, a different civilization. Their language bears no resemblance to Arabic. It's not a Semitic language. They themselves are not Semites by ethnic origin. So it's a totally different people. Of course, they're Muslims, but they're not Arabs. And this actually is a very important thing to understand about Iranian behavior. Much of what they're doing in the region is because they're not Arabs, and they wish to dominate the region. And so they have a kind of legitimacy gap, and they try to make up that legitimacy gap in various ways. And actually, one of the ways in which they try to seek to address that issue is by opposing Israel, by trying to grab the banner, so to speak, of the Palestinian cause, and thus get over the fact that they themselves are not Arabs and are not liked by the Arabs. So there's a calculated element of that, as well as an ideological element. It's not just that they hate Israel and wish to destroy it; they do, but it's also that this activity against Israel has a kind of instrumental value for the Iranians as well.
Although those who will say that there's just the regime, that the Iranian people themselves are possibly not as anti-Israel.
Oh yeah, no, we're talking about the regime, not mm-hmm. the Iranian people. But of course, this is an authoritarian regime. It doesn't necessarily have to ask the opinions of the people. Undoubtedly, I mean, certainly, I'm no expert on Iran, but just from listening to people who are, what I understand to be the case is that Iranian civil society is not only not anti-Israel, but it's also not anti-American, not anti-Western. If the Iranian people could have a vote, they'd probably vote a pro-Western and secular government in. The problem is they're not going to get a vote anytime soon.
Well, the best case scenario would be regime change under some guise or another.
Absolutely. But we saw in 2009 with the Green Movement, the beginnings of an attempt at civil disobedience in Iran. And we saw how ruthlessly the regime put that down. My sense, at least, is that one group of people who it's very hard to make a revolution against are people who themselves are revolutionaries because they know all the tricks and because they're very determined. The people who run Iran are people who, as young men themselves in 1979, carried out a successful revolution, and they have no intention whatsoever of letting anybody carry out a successful revolution against them. And that's therefore, I think, quite unlikely. They're much more ruthless and much more well-organized than the opposition in Iran, which tends to be pro-Western and liberal and very nice, but as a result of that, much less willing to, go to it and fight in the streets than are the supporters of the regime. I think we saw that in 2009. I don't predict this regime falling anytime soon.
So there are those who will say that what the Middle East or what the world in general looks for is a superpower. The United States mm-hmm. has seemed to have backed out of that position on its own, and that the possible contenders right now, at least here in the Middle East, would be Soviet Union, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and maybe Israel. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that these are all very different countries with different interests. I mean, the Russians, I think, have certain limited interests in the region, which they will very aggressively pursue. But I don't think they are looking to sort of replace. I don't think they're looking to. I don't think they can replace the Americans as the guarantor of regional security in the role that America played. Pretty much since the 1970s, we could say, when the Soviet Union was clearly kind of began to back out mm-hmm. of the region and lose the race against the Americans, both economically and militarily. Yeah, America's now withdrawn from that role. I don't think anybody else either can or even wishes to take it on. I'm sure the Iranians would like to dominate the region. For example, if think of the list that you gave. But, the Iranians as non-Arabs and as non-Sunni Muslims...
And Shia.
Yeah, in my estimation, cannot build the kind of successful alliances outside of Shia Arab communities that would enable them to really dominate the region. And as a result of that, are not in the running to do it. They can be people who can ensure regional instability, but to ensure regional stability under their own leadership, I think, is beyond their capability. The Saudis can't do hard military power. Mm-hmm. And so they, again, are not really contenders for regional leadership. And Israel, I think, doesn't want to lead.
We don't want to.
No, Israel wants to be left alone and then to carry out, to create successful relationships largely beyond the region. Israel's interested in Asia. Israel's interested in the West, in America, right. In Europe. These are the places that Israel looks to. And regarding the region, what it seeks to do, I think, is just to successfully defend itself against parties that wish it harm, of which, of course, there are not a few.
Yeah, I remember you telling me the last time I spoke to you that the only thing that separates the Israelis from the Yazidis is the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces.
Absolutely right. Yeah, I think this is an important thing to remember. I mean, certainly when I was in northern Syria in summer of 2014, when that dreadful series of events regarding the Yazidis was taking place, that was absolutely what was on my mind. And it's not just a metaphor. You know, we should understand it's precisely the political style that led, and the political ideologies that led to what happened to the Yazidis, you know, Sunni political Islam, Arab nationalism, the absolute unwillingness to countenance difference, you know, and to countenance the rights of other peoples. These are the phenomena that led to what happened to the Yazidis, and these are the phenomena that lie behind the long campaign to try to destroy Jewish sovereignty in Israel. So it's not just, well, those were cruel people and we have nasty people against us as well. Not at all. It's a direct parallel. It's the same people with the same ideas that led to what happened to the Yazidis in Sinjar Mountain and which lie behind the long campaign to seek the destruction of Israel.
And how about Europe? What's your feeling about Christian Europe? Well, and ISIS, Brussels, and some of the other attacks that we've seen in the past few weeks?
Yeah, well, my sense is that what's taking place in Europe right now is beginning to have the look no longer of isolated terrorist attacks, but of something like a low-level insurgency. That's to say, you know, areas like Molenbeek, for example, in Brussels and elsewhere too, you know, there are no-go areas for the police and for the security forces, and where wanted terrorists, as we see from the Paris attackers, can hide out for, you know, 2 or 3 months and not be found. These are no longer just areas of disaffected immigrants. These are almost, you know, places from which the state has to some degree withdrawn, and in which there is very high level support for Islamist ideas and also for violent activity. So I think that the tempo of events, you know, is starting to look more like a low level insurgency by Islamist organizations than simply occasional terror attacks. And as ISIS loses ground, and it is losing ground in Syria and in Iraq, I think it is more likely, and we're seeing this pattern, that organization will turn towards international terrorism. And we're seeing that. A very interesting investigative report in the New York Times a couple of days ago, which showed the extent to which these ISIS attacks in Europe were not the work of lone wolves or just of random guys who on the internet self-radicalized. On the contrary, that these are being controlled out of the Islamic State itself. These are being, you know, ordered by Islamic State. This is a very much an organized process, and I think it's not going to get any better anytime soon.
So ironically, as ISIS loses ground in the Middle East, Europe is going to get higher.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so. Not only necessarily even in Europe. Of course, there was San Bernardino that took place in the United States, and one should not assume that the United States is immune to any of this either. But I do think that we're going to see ISIS sort of turning more towards international terror as it kind of progressively sees its holdings in Syria and Iraq chipped away at, so to speak, by the coalition of forces aligned against it.
So one last question. Can we stop? Can this be stopped? Do we have a very bloody next century facing us?
Yeah, I think so. I think I don't think that political Islam is going to be victorious in the end. I think that it will be stopped. But absolutely, this is a matter of civilizational import. I mean, there is a huge civilizational convulsion going on at the heart of the Arab and Islamic world, which is producing these ideologies, these ideas, and these organizations. And it's not going to end anytime soon. It's going to be the business of much of our lives, I think, trying to hold this back. Ultimately, the transformation can only come from within Arab and Islamic society itself. Those of us who are not Arabs and Muslims mainly will have the task, well, first of all, reporting and understanding it, but also mainly the task of defending our societies against this. We're not going to be able to transform that from within. That's going to have to come from those societies themselves. In the interim, and before that happens, yeah, we're going to be pretty busy, I think, with trying to fight this stuff off.
That's a very interesting point that you make, because I think too many people from the West are trying to change Arab society, bring democratic elections, whatever it is, and they're not going to happen. People have to change themselves.
Absolutely right. Yeah, we can't do that. And actually, we would be ill-advised to waste blood and treasure seeking to do so, because as we see from the Iraq invasion of 2003, you know, these societies cannot be transformed from without. You can't, attractive as the idea may seem at certain moments, you can't just send the 3rd Infantry Division to an Arab capital and then turn it into a democracy. This is a fool's errand, as we are now familiar. And I think the more modest goals that, for example, Israel sets itself vis-a-vis the Arab world, namely to defend itself against threats and to ensure its security, and where possible to align with allies on the ground there, but not to openly involve itself. I think it's a far more sensible way to go. And in this way, as well as other ways, I think that the Western world, you know, maybe has something to learn from the Israeli example.
I think they have a lot to learn from the Israeli example. I hope they're listening. Thank you so much, Jonathan Speier. It's April 3rd, 2016. Always happy to talk to you. We'll be back in a few weeks.
Thanks very much.
And just in the meantime, take care of yourselves. And everybody, read him, Jonathan Speier. His eyes and his body are where the rest of us don't go. And we absolutely need to hear what he has to say. Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. Take care, everybody. Goodbye for now.